any specific people about to be mentioned have signed waivers allowing that to happen. Attorney-client privilege was not compromised during the taping of this interview. Hi, Jessa. Thanks for joining me again. For those who are just joining the series of jury breaks, Jessa Nicholson-Getz is a sensitive crimes criminal defense attorney from Madison, Wisconsin. She's generous enough to share her expertise with us about a broad range of topics, and this week we're discussing the jury system. So I wanted to jump in, Jessa, with a previous email to me that you wrote. You mentioned it was wrong or possibly illegal that Samantha's jury is focusing on the character of the defendant during their deliberations. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Sure. So generally speaking, and there are exceptions to every rule, but generally speaking, character evidence in the guilt phase of a trial is admitted only on a very limited basis. So in the state of Wisconsin, in my state, the two areas that you can really put character evidence in are, I can offer evidence about someone's character for truthfulness, or in cases where self-defense is an issue, I'm able to put evidence in about someone's character for peacefulness. And then the state, similarly, is typically prohibited from introducing things that speak to a defendant's character. Here in our state, the statute is 90404. And 90404 says that you can't introduce any evidence of someone's character and that they were acting in conformance therewith. So that's another way of saying you can't enter propensity evidence. You can't say this guy is a child molester and we know that, so you should assume he molested this particular child. Now, there are a bunch of exceptions to that too. And one of the major battles pretrial that I almost always find myself having with the prosecution is there are all of these little exceptions that the prosecution will attempt to use to essentially make the propensity argument. They can seek to introduce things that purport to go to motive or identification or modus operandi. But what was originally supposed to be very limited evidence has sort of run off the rails and is becoming more and more, in my view, improperly admissible. But the concept of trying the crime and not the defendant is a long-held legal principle that we have. So while you can ask some very limiting background questions to kind of get a witness comfortable on the stand, how old are you married, things like that, some of the really in-depth things about what does this person value or what is this person like from day to day, the jury just doesn't get to hear that. And so it was particularly interesting to me in the early episodes to hear them saying, well, I just don't have a feel for her character. Because I think what they were trying to talk about was, I can't tell if I think she's the type of person who would want to do this. And to a certain extent, you know, they're asked to evaluate credibility, all juries are. And part of a credibility determination is whether or not you find people honest or that their recollection is clear or unclear. But you're not supposed to say, you know, this person is engaged in an alternative lifestyle that I find repugnant, and I can draw conclusions about his or her criminality as a result of that. And Carl in particular, I feel like Carl gets picked on, but Carl in particular really seemed to be focused on throughout his conversations about what kind of horrible or cruel or dominating or abusive person the defendant was. And it's a fine line to talk about if you think behaviors are horrible or cruel or criminal and the person, but you're supposed to be looking at the behaviors and not the person.
I see. That makes sense. And I did have a follow-up question. Earlier you said truthfulness or peacefulness. What did you mean by peacefulness?
So there's a whole line of cases. And again, this is, I'm speaking about Wisconsin law, although there is federal law that weaves into our decisions. In our state, if I want to argue self-defense, so if there's a homicide and I'm saying, well, my client acted in self-defense, I can call witnesses to say, hey, have you known Joe for a long time? And they can say, yeah, I've known Joe for 25 years. how do you know him? And they could talk a little bit about how they came to be in contact with him. Is he a friend? Is he a neighbor, an employee, things like that. And then you can say, based on your contact with him, have you been able to form an opinion about if he's a peaceful person or a violent person? And typically, if the defense is calling this character witness, we're expecting the character to say, you know, the character witness to say, well, I think he's a peaceful person, and it's not in his character to start fights. Similarly, a common fight in self-defense cases is when the defense tries to get in something called McMorris evidence. So that's when we want to say, look, the dead guy was the violent guy. And my client knew the dead guy was a violent guy. And that was part of what went into his or her decision making. When they acted the way that they did and they took the steps to protect themselves that they did. If you knew that a person who was coming at you regularly carried a firearm and had been convicted of multiple violent felonies, you would probably approach that differently than if you were talking to a person who you knew scared easily or just avoided conflict. So that's kind of how the peacefulness works, is it's an argument about who would start fights after the fact.
Wow, that's really interesting. I'd never learned about peacefulness before in that context. So that's that's really, really fascinating. You touched on this again with me prior to this interview, and I wanted to bring it up because I thought it was really important. How do issues like race and socioeconomic status affect the jury system in your home county?
So my home county is really an outlier. In my home county, because the campus is such a huge part of life here in Madison, most of our jurors have bachelor's degrees, if not higher than that. So I regularly have people who have master's degrees and PhDs sitting on my Dane County juries, my Madison juries. If you go even an hour outside of Madison, so just, you know, there are these surrounding counties that are much smaller counties, you'll have a jury that oftentimes there are only two or three people who have education beyond high school. And so there's a really big difference in the education level of jurors depending on county to county. And here in Wisconsin, it's actually quite striking because the Dane County population is just so comparatively well-educated. Another thing about the Dane County population compared to other populations in the state, though really our state is not a wildly diverse state, is Dane County juries are overwhelmingly white. I think I can count on both hands the number of people I've had of color in my juries, and I've tried dozens. I couldn't even tell you how many trials I've had.
And oh, wow, that is white.
It's very rare. There are rules in jury selection. There's a United States Supreme Court case called Bastion that requires that prosecutors are unable to strike potential jurors just solely on the basis of race. There's a follow-up decision to that that makes that true for gender as well. Oftentimes, when we're picking a jury here, if someone of color is struck, we'll have to have a sidebar and talk about if there was what we refer to as a race-neutral or a gender-neutral reason for striking that person. And the lawyer who's made the strike has to provide that information. So it is something that there are rules in place from sort of higher courts to dictate. And it's also something that is a strategic question in every case that you have, depending on what the facts are. Do I want a jury that is going to see things in a very nuanced way? Do I want a jury that is going to appeal to the emotion of a case and less the technical legal aspects of a case? There are certain stereotypes that people believe about the age and the gender of jurors. Some people want, you know, young people in child abuse cases, for example. People tend to want older jurors. That's a very common stereotype because physical discipline has sort of gone out of fashion over the different generations. So when you get older people, they're more sympathetic to the use of physical discipline. So, you know, if you pick a case with specific facts, there are going to be all sorts of theories on what your right jury is. And there's a whole industry of jury consultants out there that make pretty good livings trying to advise on that.
Do you find that stereotyping comes into play a lot during the process of jury selection?
You know, I think it does, because there isn't a lot else that you really get to rely on. In Wisconsin, we have open voir dire, meaning that both attorneys and the judge ask all of the potential jurors questions. In some courts, the judge will do all of the questioning during voir dire, and voir dire is the jury selection process. So in those jurisdictions in particular, I imagine that there's quite a bit of reliance on stereotype, because you as the lawyer don't even get to speak to the jury directly, because I get to question everyone in my panels. I get a little bit more information from them, and so I'm able to make a little bit more of an individualized decision about keeping or rejecting a juror, but I certainly do rely on stereotypes. I can give you an example of that, which is in sexual assault cases. It is actually my personal belief that women are harder on complaining witnesses than men. So perhaps counterintuitively, I wouldn't necessarily be looking to seat an all-male jury or a predominantly male jury in a sexual assault case, because women tend to engage in some what are pretty common biases. And one of those is this sort of identification bias of, well, I don't think this would happen to me, and so I don't believe it happened to her. I wouldn't act like that, so I don't think any woman will act like that.
Whoa, that is the opposite of what I'd expect.
The other thing, and there's a really cool study on the subject of gender and jury selection that I read recently, and I'll try and find the article and send it to you so you can put it up on the Facebook page or anything. But it talks about how some of the best jurors for defense attorneys in sex crimes trials are men that present as benevolent sexists. So chivalrous men. Men that open the door for women, men that believe they're supposed to pay for dinner, men that believe that, you know, women and children first, and that they would be the protector in the home. Those are men that, while they might look like they're pretty pro woman and therefore pro accuser, in the majority of sexual assault cases, the accuser is a woman. That's obviously not always true, but it still is the majority of things. But they'll see, you know, the idea is you think, oh, these are men that want to protect a woman and will do what they can to make sure that she's heard and taken care of, because they have these tendencies towards being fatherly or being protective. And as it turns out, the psychological reality is that a lot of times that benevolent sexism is founded in what I would call sort of a modern day Madonna whore idea, which is, once they hear something that suggests a woman isn't as worthy of their protection as their hypothetical woman is, that then they'll turn on them really quickly.
Wow.
And I thought that was a fascinating thing to read. And that's something that I've tried to incorporate in my last few jury selections in those types of cases, to ask questions about, you know, do you think that a man should pay for dinner, and things that might not necessarily immediately connect with being relevant, but there's science that suggests that it is.
Oh my God. At first, when you said keep an eye out, I thought you meant like watching to see if they open the doors for all of the females.
Well, I mean, look, I have all sorts of weird superstitions when I pick juries. So like, I do pay a lot of attention to what people come wearing, what they're carrying. You know, I like people who come in carrying books. I like people who come in wearing bright colors, because those people tend to be less afraid of drawing attention to themselves. So colorfully dressed people tend to be good jurors for the defense, because they're independent thinkers they're perhaps not as likely to bow to pressure. I ask a lot of questions about if people are stubborn and, you know, how they approach a problem. And would your spouse say that you're willing to compromise? Things like that, because I, of course, want jurors that'll stand their ground and not just agree to convict someone because they're tired or they feel outnumbered.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine pressure plays a huge factor in deliberations nationwide. Have you ever used, just out of curiosity, have you ever used a jury consultant?
So I have consulted with jury consultants. I've never had one that sat all the way through our trial. I have on a couple of occasions. We have a local tech college here that has a paralegal studies program. They will do mock juries for you. So I have done mock trials where we've hired a retired judge to preside, and then we've brought people in to do our mock juries. I've done that more often. The jury consultants that I've spoken to have offered some helpful advice, but well, here, just to put it blankly, a lot of times they're just extraordinarily expensive. And it's not always feasible when you're given the choice of devoting resources and a somewhat limited resource reality. You know, I can either call the alternative expert to explain the DNA evidence, or I can call a jury consultant. And obviously, the substantive expert is going to be more beneficial. But I do think that those people have a lot of insight, and I think it's valuable.
Right. Yeah, the budget concern makes sense to me. The mock trials are definitely something that I want to discuss with you in a future interview. That's okay, because I think that's really interesting. But you mentioned something to me previously that I wanted to touch on today. Can you tell us what the Allen charge is?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you what the Allen charge is. So criminal juries have to be unanimous. And the Allen charge is this charge that, so your jury goes out and they're out for 10 hours or 12 hours or 4 days or whatever, however long they're out, and they're deadlocked. So the jury foreperson usually sends a note and says, we're deadlocked. We're, you know, we can't decide. And the judge will give an instruction that is commonly referred to as the Allen charge. At this point, the lawyers have probably made a record talking about why there should be a mistrial, where so a defense attorney, after however many hours getting that note, is going to say, well, judge, they're deadlocked. I want the jury to be hung. You know, I'm moving for a mistrial. And often, not every judge, but many judges will give this instruction that basically says, you guys are as competent as any other possible jury to decide this, so get back in there and make a compromise. And I, in my view, that's coercive. Particularly because, again, I can't speak for everyone nationwide, but in my home county, the jury will deliberate until they ask to go home. So sometimes they're given an Allen charge at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And then we get a verdict an hour later, and you can't help but wonder, is that because it was 10 to 2 to convict in the middle of the night and somebody wanted to go to sleep? Oh, did they feel like they didn't have any option other than to make a decision after hearing that instruction? So, you know, it's concerning. I don't like it. Once a case goes to jury, I don't like it when any player in the system has contact with them. I think once they get to deliberations, that should be as sacred and as separated as possible. And so getting new instructions after they've done lengthy, hard work just always presents as a concern for me. And I don't know any defense attorney that disagrees with that view. If you find one, let me know. If there's somebody who's like, yeah, the Allen charge works out great for me. I haven't met them yet, but.
No, I mean, I'm sure not. That I can't imagine the feeling someone must have if they lose a case immediately after an Allen charge was issued. Like, that must be really devastating.
Right, because the implication to the jury is that, you know, you guys just all have to find a way to agree. And I think whoever's in the majority ultimately ends up just persuading the people in the minority, which right. If that happens naturally, that's cool. You know, I mean, that's the function of jury deliberations. As long as people understand that they can be deadlocked. I mean, it's not ideal, but they can be.
Yeah, that and needs no to be an option.
To give up a closely held belief about something as serious as innocence or guilt. In order just to complete it. I mean, yes, it's a ton of time and money went, particularly when you've got something like a hung jury on a homicide or a sexual assault. They're long trials, they're difficult to do, and they take up a lot of court resources. So obviously the judges and everybody else has incentive to see a verdict be rendered. I just don't think that it should come at the cost of compromising the integrity of it. And I do worry that some jurors feel very pressured.
I definitely would. I can't imagine being, I was just trying to, in this moment, imagine being one person against 11 people, and I've managed to hold my ground this long. That's a really stressful situation.
And I think when you add to it sleep deprivation, which is so often the case here, and totally not for any, you know, malicious reason, it also so happens that our courthouse, the air conditioning's on a timer. So the air conditioning goes off at like 6 or 7 p.m. So in those like nighttime juries in the summer in particular, it's getting hotter and hotter in that room, and it's getting later and later.
That sounds like the conditions in like a really tense interrogation room.
Right. Like it sounds kind of horrible. And this most recent episode, listening to the jury talk where they're like, yeah, look, I'm tired and I feel disconnected from my wife. And I get all of that. And, you know, some of the comments I read on the Facebook page were like, people shouldn't be more concerned about what the church is going to say than what they're doing. And while I wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment, I think realistically, people do get tired and they do miss their families. If you read any of the commentary from jurors that have been sequestered for long periods of time, honestly, they sound really similar to some of my clients who have been incarcerated. I mean, it can be that intense when there are lengthy trials and they have, you know, they have to go back to the hotel and they can't have contact with the outside world. It's really advanced citizenship to ask people to serve on a jury because they're hearing traumatic things and difficult things, and they're really uprooted from their lives. It's not an easy job, which is always why it makes me angry when I hear attorneys make jokes about, oh, 12 people who are too stupid to get out of jury duty, which is an old lawyer joke. You know, these people aren't stupid. Like, they're doing the best they can. And all of my juries, whether they've ultimately done the thing I think they should or not, I've always felt that I had juries that were thoughtful, and if they had questions, they'll send a question out. Those questions are always really considered, and you can tell, I think, that people take it seriously, and I just appreciate that so much. And I know it's a big ask from citizens.
Absolutely. Do you prefer a jury, or do you prefer a judge?
I want a jury every time. Really? I always want a jury.
Why is that?
Most notably, a lot of judges are jaded. They hear the same thing every day. They see defendants who largely plead guilty because, you know, only, 2 to 5% of criminal cases go to trial. Most of the time, the issue really is an issue of fact, not law. You know, was there consent? That's a fact question. Was the self-defense? That's a fact question. Those are things that I think are best decided by the peer group and not by somebody with legal expertise. There are some cases where it's a legal defense only, so it's really kind of a technical defense. So for example, in our state, drunk driving cases, you have to prove the number of priors, okay? So, because we do like OWI first and second and third and fourth and blah, blah, blah. Juries typically don't hear what number OWI somebody is on because it can be prejudicial. If I, for example, really thought that the only question was the OWI third conviction legally binding? Now, that would probably be dealt with in a pretrial issue, but in my strange hypothetical here, if that really was the only question we were fighting about and that was coming in at trial, then maybe that'd be a situation where you'd say, you know what, this is really just about the judge deciding the validity of this legal issue, and so I'll waive that jury. But I would always prefer to have the jury. In any case where there's a factual dispute, I want more minds and more perspectives and more ideas, because judges are human beings just like the rest of us, and they come in with their own preconceived notions and biases. And even if they work very hard to be fair, everybody has their perspective. And so I want as many voices as possible to try and find perspectives that line up with my clients versus the state's.
I see. Well, that sounds like a really positive note about juries to reach an end on. Jessa, thank you so much for talking with us again. You touched on a lot of interesting topics that I may want to explore more in future. I'm imagining that there are going to be some follow-up questions to some of the things you talked about. But before we sign off, I wanted to know if you could remind everyone, if they want to find out more information about you or your work, how they can do that.
Sure. My law firm is Nicholson, Gansner & Otis, and our website is nglawyers.com. We maintain a couple blogs there. The firm Twitter account is at Nicholson Law, NG Lawyers. My personal Twitter is 456 AM if anyone wants to follow my retweets. And you can follow me personally on Instagram at jessa.kate.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time, Jessa. I'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks, Chelsea.
That's it for our jury break. We'll be speaking with Jessa again next week, but in 2 days, we're releasing episode 12, part one of a two-parter entitled The Verdict. Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it. Follow Deliberations on Twitter at DeliberationPod or join the conversation on Facebook inside the Facebook group Deliberations Room. If you have follow-up questions for Jessa, please email them to deliberationspod@gmail.com. We'll see you in 2 days.